Welcome to the, as usual, late session of House Special Session Committee on Economic Growth and Job Development for Tuesday, September 10th, 2002. We have members just in the audience to let you know what our format is for today. We are going to have the introduction of legislation from Representative Tom Butler, which I would like to be introduced in the committee. We are also going to work amendments of my bill, House Bill 4072, and we will have some additional amendments likely on both of these pieces of legislation. We intend to meet back again after lunch, depending on what the schedule for the day is, which I think has not yet been determined by leadership. You'll need to keep yourselves available because we intend to work both of these bills. My intent is to pass out House Bill 4072 today, and then hopefully work further either today or tomorrow, Representative Butler's bill once it's assigned a bill number. That's my intention for the day. We'll start with welcoming Representative Tom Butler. Thank you, Tom, for coming. You have an LC draft of your concept that you shared with us the other day. All the members have it. Why don't you just share some thoughts additionally here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60 from Ontario and representing the Southeast 25%+ of Oregon's landmass. It's my great privilege to represent this great rural district. However, this is not a rural district bill. The LC 16 of September 9th, which you have in front of you, is a bill which comes forward as a result of working with the higher tech industries in the metropolitan areas of Oregon. It comes forward as an opportunity to go ahead and examine the way that we bring new and better talent into the state of Oregon. This bill attempts to bring new-to-Oregon individuals who are leaders in industry and in finance to the state of Oregon in an attempt to try and bring greater opportunities for larger amounts of support staff and related folks that would be coming in to be employed in Oregon's high-tech industry and to bring the capital necessary to bring what's called angel capital to the forefront to bring the financing available for the venture capital for small businesses. The three types of individuals that we are talking about attempting to attract to the state of Oregon are venture capitalists, certain venture capitalists, and the qualified bioscience individuals, highly trained, highly specialized, and then a group of high-tech executives and leaders in industry who are not presently residing in Oregon. Mr. Chair, as you'd indicated, this bill will have to have some amendments, and I'll try to identify at least a couple of those amendments as I make this presentation. With regard to the venture capitalist firms, we wanted to bring existing venture capital firms to the state of Oregon and bring one of their executives, one or more of their executives to the state of Oregon to set up offices within the state of Oregon. Those folks would be either partners, co-owners, or the executives in that particular venture capital firm. Venture capital firms are those firms which are already established, which have at least $100 million of uninvested capital within their funds. That's pre-board that they have available, and that they would be amenable and agreeable to invest at least $1 million a year. In that regard, Mr. Chair, I think on page, section four on line 15 has the exemptions or the application for the renewal fees. There's a renewal fee, there's an application fee, and then a renewal fee of each of those fees are up to $1,000, may not exceed $1,000 apiece. What we have in section four is some of the qualifications for the renewals for those firms that are venture capital firms within the state of Oregon. And it's my understanding that we probably need to put down under C, which is on lines 23 through 25, probably at the end of line 25, we would strike on line 22 the "and" at the end there, and then insert after 25 a comma or a semicolon and here we would put something with regard to the fact that annually these firms need to be making the $1 million, not less than $1 million investments in the state of Oregon, and the individual will have had to have filed or will be filing Oregon individual income tax returns as a full year full-time resident in the state of Oregon. Now that's very important. Our intention is that these folks not just be passing through the state of Oregon, but they actually come and reside within the state of Oregon. So please be aware that possibly D and E, and we will be meeting with council this morning. We just picked this up at about 6 o'clock last evening. That what we'll intend to do is make certain that that firm, venture capital firm, in order to renew annually, makes an actual investment in venture capital businesses within the state of Oregon annually, and that individual partner or venture capitalist who has brought to Oregon as a result of this legislation will have been filing Oregon income tax returns in the state of Oregon now after the first year as a full-time Oregon resident, full-year Oregon resident. Then with regard to the qualified business bioscience investments in the state of Oregon, I think the Legislative Council has done an excellent job of defining high technology. One of the concerns is that the on page one, the high technology firm means the firm which is engaged in, and that in addition to the leading edge electronic communications and other technological devices and equipment, that it's understood that some of this could be electrical components, including the high-tech components that are presently produced in Oregon, which would be used for the bioscience for monitoring human biological activities and so forth, for implants, for such things as heart rates and caloric consumption, those kinds of activities. So I think that the language is there and is sufficient to include that. There was one other concern that had been expressed to me by one of our colleagues who is an instructor and has a good teaching background, and that is the concern if these people that were making these applications wanted to also, in addition to being involved, and I'm now on page two dealing with what is presently listed as 5A, means an individual involved or engaged in upper level management position, bioscience firm, high technology firm, venture capital firm, has authority to make fundamental business decisions about the activities and continued existence of the firm. Certainly we want that, but the concern was what would happen if that individual also wanted to be involved in education, and I think that would be very appropriate if Oregon's higher institutions of higher learning wanted that person to be involved. However, they would still be in the process of doing these other things. So education would not be excluded as one of the activities in which they would be engaged, but they must also be engaged in these other activities. There's nothing in here to discourage the participation in education and Oregon's high-tech education industry, but it would still be along the lines of promoting the bioscience and higher technology and then making the basic business decisions about the activities and continued existence of those firms. And, of course, down within the body of that, for continuing forward, then that firm, in order to qualify, must have rather substantial sales. I think the annual sales, as required down on page 5, it requires that they have at least $1 million of capitalization in the state, or that they conduct business operations in locations outside of the state and has more than $20 million in annual revenues for at least the last 5 years, so that they're still involved in the biotech and high-tech industries. In that regard, and coming back again to page two, the qualified taxpayer, I think that there needs to be another sentence inserted in there, another meaning, so that there is actually four as opposed to the ABC, that there would be another definition there added for the individual who is participating, and that is it would be an individual who in the last three immediate years, two or three years, we've yet to put some definition on that, immediately prior to making application under this act would not have been an Oregon resident and had not filed an Oregon resident income tax return under the Oregon revised statutes as required. In other words, this is a new to Oregon individual that's making application, and to prevent the anti-churning, this is a kind of an anti-churning device, to provide that this individual isn't shipped out of state and made a resident of another state for a couple of years and then brought back in, during the immediate 2 years prior to making application, they should not have filed an Oregon individual income tax return as a resident. They might have Oregon income from having been involved in a high-tech industry within the state of Oregon, but they are non-residents, and it's understood that what we're doing is we're trying to bring these people into the state of Oregon. Again, we talked about the PhD or MD level of folks within the categories applying, and currently on page 2, line 9, which is presently designated as subtitle B, includes an individual bioscience firm who is engaged in biological and medical research for the firm, has oversight responsibilities concerning the research conducted by the firm, and who has authority to make fundamental decisions about direction of the research conducted by the firm. It's anticipated that those would be, in the bioscience, those would be MD-level folks, and that in the other science fields and in the bioscience fields would be PhD-level folks. However, Council has encouraged us not to put the level of actual university degree attained in the body of the legislation, because we certainly recognize that there are folks out there that the good ideas are not limited to just those folks who have got a sheepskin from a major university, and we're talking about a PhD or MD level sheepskin. So with that, Mr. Chair, we're attempting to provide within the legislation an opportunity for the firms within the state of Oregon to have a new infusion of outside capital, and in addition, a new infusion of the brain power which is necessary to continue on with biochemistry, biotechnology, and molecular biology, genetics, and life sciences, as well as the high-tech industries which Oregon has been famous for in the past. Representative, how long do you think it'll take to get your amendments put together on this thing? Mr. Chair, as I stated in my first opportunity to present before your committee, this piece of legislation has a broad base of industry input and a broad base of industry articulation of any changes. And so, I am this morning anticipating meeting with some of the bioscience folks and some of the economic development folks and high technology folks to attempt to make sure that we include all of the kinds of opportunities that there would be for this language to be inserted within the body of the bill. In addition, I am concerned that we also make absolutely certain that we do not provide, and it would bring some degree of shame to me if all we did was provide an opportunity for Oregon, or for people to come to Oregon to work in Oregon income tax free, and then gave them an opportunity to churn. And I would not want that to happen. This is an attempt to actually expand so our bioscience and high technology folks. So I'm going to guess, Mr. Chair, that it will be sometime early this afternoon before we will all have had an opportunity to get some of the feedback through email and some personal hands-on visits with some of these people, and then I can get, assuming I can get the legislative counsel, Dexter Johnson, to assist us, then I would anticipate we might be able to come back with at least the conceptual amendments early this afternoon. And Mr. Chair, there's no pride in authorship at this point, even though we've got some of Oregon's best minds crunching this information out, and I don't include myself within that August group. These are the folks from, many of them from the leaders of industry and technology in the metropolitan area. I would seek any degree of counsel from them, and certainly because Representative King is a member of that group, he brings with him special expertise in both the venture capital as well as his knowledge of industry in some of these particular high-tech areas. I would invite any concerns, any modifications, so as to accomplish the intent of the bill. The intent of the bill, again, is to bring that capital and the brain power to Oregon that's necessary to make sure that we get the next jump on the new generation of high-tech and biotech as soon as we possibly can.
Okay, Representative, any questions, members? Okay. Yes, Representative King.
I heard you say that this is not for any, that it's only for existing venture capital firms, but I don't see anything in writing here preventing anyone from qualifying if they create a new venture capital firm that has $100 million in capital. So I think it's still open that you could create a legitimate venture capital firm. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, I misspoke. That's exactly right. For those firms who would be transferring to the state of Oregon, they would be existing venture capital firms. But this would not preclude a startup venture capital firm in Oregon that would have uninvested capital of $100 million and then to commit at least $1 million of that uninvested capital annually to the state of Oregon. So you're absolutely correct. This does not preclude a startup in Oregon of a new venture capital firm.
All right. Then on page 2, line 5, it refers to upper level management, and it seems loose enough to where, you know, there could be some problems with who we're talking about there. It might suggest some language along the line of top 5 or 10% of compensation in the firm or partner principal, to help clarify that.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, we did have in the information that went to Legislative Council some very specific language in that regard. The concern that Legislative Council had was that by becoming too specific, and it was their admonition that we not use specific information, that we use insofar as possible as opposed to CFOs, CIOs, CEOs, COOs, that we use senior level, higher level managing management, upper level management, because of this very issue. It became too specific before, and I think what's happened is that in the language using the upper level management, but then delineating what authority that they have, authority to make those fundamental business decisions about the activities and continued existence of the firms, of their particular firm's existence, and the direction that they will take their research probably indicates that they are a high-level individual, and I'm somewhat reticent to delineate the percentage of salary or the level, other than the fact that they have the ability to make the fundamental business decisions in the direction where that research will go, recognizing that some of that compensation might not be in the form of actual cash, but maybe in the form of stock, and which, depending upon their election under the GAAP, may or may not show up as compensation.
Okay. When we go down to line 21, capital C, it refers to being for at least 2 years direction one of the key executive positions. of a publicly traded firm. We've just seen the draft here, so I don't have a lot of time in it. I would assume that you're allowing non-publicly traded firms to have qualification, for this tax status as well.
Mr. Chair, Irvin King, that's an excellent comment, and it's my understanding that all of those four classifications are any one of the four, so they could be or this or that. So the founding, they would have been the founder of at least one biological firm that's currently publicly traded, or founding one high technology firm that is currently publicly traded, ongoing, and has $50 million in annual sales, and then being for at least 2 years duration the chief executive officer, member of the board, president, managing partner of a high technology firm that's currently publicly traded, ongoing concern, $100 million sales, or is serving currently on five other boards, the board of directors, bioscience and high technology firms. So the first, you're right, the first three do contemplate that those are publicly traded firms, and I think the emphasis is towards bringing these, this is past the IPO, and is in the, this is actually in the formation of the preparing the final development of the technology, the bioscience, to move it to the market, and the bill excludes marketing and sales. That is not what this is all about. Our agreement was that if they found a cure for cancer, that they'd have to go market and sell that themselves. That we're interested in the cure for cancer being found in Oregon. And then that be within a publicly traded company. But Mr. Chair, I share Representative King's concern that this is very, very narrow. This certainly narrows it down, because a publicly traded firm, they may be right on the edge of the publicly traded firm and really not be in a publicly traded firm. In other words, pre-IPO. And if it's preliminary to that initial public offering, then that would not be a publicly traded firm, but I would certainly take counsel, and perhaps outside of the committee, Representative King could work with the other authors of the document and myself, because it seemed to me that was very, very restrictive relating to the persons who, in the bioscience fields, who could participate in this.
Just to add a comment, I think we're in agreement there that a lot of what we'd be aiming at here would be substantial amount of activity would be before IPO, before being publicly traded. So I think we do need to have in some sort of structure so that a company that's not publicly traded, would qualify. But I'm not sure of the details of how you get to there in this moment. So,
Representative, that's a very good point. And Representative Butler, I would prefer that we have language in this legislation. It seems to make sense to me that we would not want to preclude an organization such as you described. Private, that may be going into the IPO stage. I think we want to attract the best and the brightest here and give them opportunities and reasons to come to this state and conduct business. So if you can adopt some language.
Mr. Chair, if I could just make a proposal, let's see if this might respond to Representative King's concerns that the that this person that would be the qualified individual, a qualified taxpayer, would then in addition to all of the above, including a history of, if we could drop out the currently is, the bioscience firm that currently is, and then as opposed to A, put an ongoing concern, not publicly traded, and do the same in on line 17, do the same on line 19, and the same on line 23, is an ongoing concern, and on line 23 is an ongoing concern going on to line 24. deleting in all three cases the words publicly traded and making the A an, so that it's an ongoing concern on each three of those items. Now, Mr. Chair, I would seek counsel from Representative King and others if this is responsive.
Works fine for me if it makes sense to Dexter that he doesn't see any problems with that.
Okay, well, I appreciate that, Representative King. I appreciate your thoughts.
I'm going to go on to D then.
You want to go on to D?
On line 25, it said five of the boards. That's actually quite a few. Maybe three is a better number.
Okay. Representative Butler, on line 25, Representative King thought it might be better to change five other boards to three other boards. Okay, at least three other boards of directors for biosciences. And Mr. Chair, thank you very much, Representative King. This is responsive. Again, the high bar that we were trying to do was to attract those people who had either were in the publicly traded arena already or that were already involved significantly, looking for an opportunity to attract really successful bioscience and researchers and technologists from outside the state of Oregon who are already in there. And I think the high bar was based upon some of the personal knowledge of the members of the subcommittee that I'm serving with. And I had the pleasure of having Mr. Ron Fox here from Economic Development, too, that assists in one of those committees. But certainly that the three serving on the boards of directors of three bioscience or high technology firms would open that door to other people with excellent experience. Anyone that presently serves on those boards would have to be fairly high caliber individual. And we're attempting to bring people to the state of Oregon who have high capacity for education, high capacity for earning capacities as well, Mr. Chair.
I think that's an excellent point. My concern is that you don't make the bar so high that we're not able to achieve the goal, which is an important goal that you're hoping to achieve. Representative King?
Well, I'm happy with whatever they decide. The other side of it is that I think one of the purposes of legislation is to get these kind of individuals to be involved with more companies so we do more cross-pollinating, and I don't want to undo that goal. But in terms of, you know, goal of getting, the right kind of person to the state, I don't want them board chasing or, not focusing their time where it's most productive. So I'm happy with whatever they conclude on that. Then on page 4, if we go to line 11B, we see the word affiliated with, and as I remember from testimony that we had from Microlite, who's an employee and who is not is a significant issue. This says affiliated, which could be loose. I would look to see if it was employed, an owner, a principal, a partner, or that under contract with, maybe a little more clear on that. I don't know if you were able to follow that. I don't think he was.
I beg your pardon.
Mr. Fox, maybe you were able to follow that, because I think you were following that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I think the intent was to leave, probably with the wording that you're having, talked to. So the legislative council, but to leave the wording flexible enough that the individual firms could structure whatever time of whatever type of professional employment or contractual relationship worked best for them. So you might have someone working on a contract, resident in Oregon, performing the management and research duties and meet the intent of this without defining it as employee employment per se.
Mr. Chair, I would say relative to venture capital firms, that may be particularly an issue because those folks may reside in Oregon and be doing work outside the state of Oregon. I don't know if that's responsive to Representative King's concerns.
Right. Okay, that's fine. And then,
Representative King, I spoke with Pat Gibson, who, as you know, is a member of the committee, and he, relative to the venture capital executor, he was very clear that what we were looking for are the principal partners. So in that context, it may be a narrower definition of the applicability than with the bioscience firm. We're really looking for, from a venture capital firm, for those people who have the decision-making control over investment funds that they manage.
Okay. And then on page 7, line 26, you know, item 3, it looks like there's a little difference in approach here from what we had discussed in your initial conceptual presentation, that it looks like now that the tax event is correlated to firm correlated income as versus, you know, all income of the individual. You know, so we wouldn't have a circumstance like a Bill Gates starts up a venture capital firm and then has all of his other income, you're exempted. Now we're only firm correlated.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, that's exactly right. It's all of that income, including the capital return that's involved around this particular Oregon activity and Oregon investment. And so that it is just that Oregon, we're attempting to try and isolate it as Oregon, and that is a modification from where we were at, because I think council felt that we were unable to control the bonuses and commissions and so forth from other activities that they would have out of state and their investments out of state. Recognizing that if they're an Oregon resident, they would pay tax on that foreign state income, but then receive a tax credit for those taxing states as they do that in Oregon. So that would accommodate some states. But if you did have a Bill Gates move to Oregon as a result of something of this nature, then all of that income, which was non-Oregon, could be taxed to the state of Oregon if there's no commensurate credit for a tax paid in another state.
Then I believe my last item in relation to that would be on page 8, line 4, in A. It says 10 consecutive tax years. It seems liberal to me. I think a 5 might be sufficient.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, I think that certainly starting off with 5 would work. My concern is that they have to have enough, or the hook has to be big enough to try and attract the folks. The other concern would be that if you had immediately a large number of qualified applications, then legislatively we may be able to shut that off from a legislative standpoint, not after the number of years for those that were participating, but actually then remove the bar or move the bar higher for any new individuals that would qualify under this. The concern again was to make sure that they had enough time in Oregon to receive some kind of a return on their investments and anticipate that. And that's why the 10 consecutive years was anticipated. In the alternative, one of the suggestions was 7 to 10 years. And so if we move that to 7 years, certainly the folks, you know, the dot-com industry, 7 years appears to be a goodly amount of time. So I, Mr. Chair, in that regard, I think that we could take counsel from Representative King and move that to 7 years on page 8, line 4. And I think that that would be, and we'll go back to the folks on the committee, Representative King, and seek their counsel. But I think that they're anxious that there be enough opportunity for these folks to work and to see a return on their investment. And 7 would be, was the original suggestion, 7 to 10 years.
Thank you.
Okay, members, if there's no further questions, are there? Okay, do we have any additional testimony at this point from anyone else in the audience? AOI, if you can, quickly. We have a caucus meeting here we're going to have to get to. Welcome.
Harvey here. Harvey Matthews from Associated Oregon Industries. One of our standing principles is to make sure that there's adequate business capital in the state. And with current negotiations being such that we are considering an increase in taxation on corporations, this is a perfect opportunity for us to send a different message to companies outside the state. I fully want to encourage the adoption of the amendments that are being discussed. I'd also encourage us to define resident more completely. We'll make sure that we don't have a P.O. box issue. But also, I want to clarify that capital gains is included in this as part of the tax break.
Representative Butler, if you could come forward, please.
That's on page 7, sorry, on line 26, it seems to be, but I want to make sure we've been talking about individual income tax returns. Would capital gains be a part of this?
Yes, Mr. Chair, again, Representative Butler, excuse me, the definition but includes all of the income derived from the qualifying affiliation of the firm, including wages, salaries, guarantee payments, bonuses, commissions, transfers of stock and other property from the firm, and a gain from the sale of the stock or ownership interest in the firm without regard to whether or not the taxpayer acquired the stock or ownership interest from the firm or elsewhere. So this would respond to the capital issue that we are concerned about, that the capital gains during the period of time that this particular individual, the qualifying applying individual, qualifies and has the gain, then that gain would be tax-free to the state of Oregon, including the capital gain from this particular entity and activity.
Representative King?
I think it's included, but when you look at it, you want to include more specificity that you know, there could be some spin-offs. Where parts of the company were sold but not the whole company. I think that's included within that, but you may want to consider that. Also, I think the word royalty is not there, and since you're dealing with intellectual property, that you may want that word in there.
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent on line 28 after the words after the words bonuses, commissions. I think royalties needs to certainly be inserted there. And that's an excellent suggestion. And then I think with regard to the sale of stock or other interest, the firm, without regard to whether the taxpayer acquired the stock directly from the company or not, probably would be in relationship to spinoffs would be the responsibility. And in order to do a tax-free spinoff for Internal Revenue Service, you have to allocate that. So I think that that's and perhaps Deborah from the Department of Revenue or someone else could tell us, but I believe that typically that those spinoffs that, again, if they sell that within the 7-year period that they're qualifying and continue to make application of the qualification could be income tax free.
I'm looking at the prospect of maybe some division of the company, or they might create 5 or 6 products and the right the one product or one product line is sold off. That's not necessarily selling the company, that's selling some assets of the company.
And Mr. Chair, if I could respond to that, it provides for the gain of the sale of stock or other ownership interest in the firm, and I'm assuming that any of the property interests may be included in that, but I think that's excellent for any other ownership interests of whatever nature.
I agree. I think the net captures that I was just bringing up the point that that facet maybe you want to look at in case for some reason it's connected.
Thank you.
Representative Butler, Dexter Johnson is in the audience behind you. Do you need his additional expertise in terms of language here at this time?
I will need his expertise in language, Mr. Chair, probably to review many of the items which have been presented today and are of concern to make sure that this is attracting new to Oregon taxpayers and then taxpayers that aren't just churning from one state to another.
Representative Harvey brought up the point of perhaps further defining the word resident so there's no P.O. box type of abuse that could be. You may want to consider that. And Harvey, you have additional concerns or points that ought to be addressed here?
Well, as far as the application process goes, in Section 3 with the Department of Economic Development, there seems to be a little confusion. It says if somebody moves here or has been here for the last 12 months, then they can make application here. And then there's also a section, I believe in Section 4, from perhaps later in Section 3, where they talk about, well, you need to be a new Oregon resident, and you couldn't have filed a tax form in the last fiscal year.
So we want to think there's some potential conflict
there? Maybe. So I'm sure we'll be able to fix that.
Okay.
And I know that agencies are supposed to inform you of any rule changes, but I would like there to be a review during this next session, whenever that may be, of what administrative rules are around this by the legislature, and specifically state that.
Maybe end of September.
Okay, so you're Harvey, you're asking for specific language in the bill that calls for review of the administrative rules by a standing legislative body during the next regular session. Is that correct?
Or any next session, yes.
Or any next session.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Anything else, Harvey?
No, just that Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development was charged by the legislature to do this. It's a bipartisan group, and it's industry experts. And I think this is something successful. This is something that can be a magnificent new program that the rest of the nation will look at. And in a time of budget crunches, when you guys are having to make terrible, drastic decisions, this is a ray of hope for burgeoning industry.
Excellent. Anything additionally, Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think in our first presentation and opportunity to present this, I think it was brought out at that time that this is the idea of one of the subcommittees that does not come before the full Oregon Coalition and Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, but that it has the support of various members at this point. We haven't had an opportunity to really work this through all of the issues for that reason. Representative King, who is a member of a couple of the subcommittees, his input is vital. As Mr. Matthews indicates, this is, in fact, a group of folks on a bipartisan arrangement to try and spur on employment and job activity in the state of Oregon.
All right. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
And with that, we're going to close the informational hearing and open a work session. I'd like to have a member move adoption of LC 16 as a committee bill.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of LC 16 as a committee bill.
Okay, it's been moved. We adopt LC 16 as a committee bill, further noting that there will be additional amendments to this bill that we will work later in the day. So at that point, the chair would like to ask that all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? It is so moved to adopt LC 16 as a committee bill. And we are going to stand in recess until 1:30 this afternoon, wherein we will be hearing the amendments on House Bill 4072. And we'll probably be looking at the Dash 5s. And we are recessed until 1:30. What are we called, Ray? Where are we here?
Special Committee on Economic Growth and Job Development, Mr. Chair.
For September 10th, 2002. We have some Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 4072, which is my bill that I introduced. We're not going to work the amendments for the moment because we don't have a quorum for a work session, and actually it's my understanding that this bill has to be referred down here and actually hasn't been from the floor, is my understanding. So we then procedurally, Ray, do what?
we can sort of talk about the amendments. Is that it, conceptually? And then,
Mr. Chair, are you saying that House Bill 4072 has not gone through first reading?
It has gone through first reading, yes.
And been referred to this committee?
I believe it had, and Christine seemed to imply that it would need to be referred down again. That didn't make any sense to me. I just went with what she said. She might have been referring to Representative Butler's bill. I have not had a first reading.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would request we get clarification on that, because if we go ahead, you as a chair and this is a committee, go ahead and start working a bill that hasn't been referred down here, we could have some parliamentary issues that we run into.
Okay. Let's stand at ease, Ray. Would you check that out for us, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Chair, we're taking a look at the House Bill 4072-5 amendments, which you brought forward. There was a parliamentary question. This bill has been referred to this committee and can be worked. The earlier reference to what hadn't been referred to this committee was the legislative concept adopted by this committee this morning, which has not gone through first reading.
Right, which is Representative Butler's concept.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
LC 16 that we were adopting as a...
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. Okay, well, we have some Dash 5 amendments here, members that have, I think, addressed a lot of the issues that were expressed the other day, and I think are clearly good points that needed to be talked about. Basically, the Dash 5s, as I understand them, we made a change in this legislation. Originally, it was to be eligible, a firm had to employ 100 or fewer. We're now down to 50 and fewer. We thought it would be better to concentrate a little more on mom and pop Main Street small business. You still have to assume a 10% growth in your overall number of employees based on the prior calendar year, okay, to be qualified. Still have to be a full-time employee. That means you, and the definition is still the same, 37 and a half hours per week. And we had originally, I frankly had miscalculated. My original calculation was that we would allow a tax credit of 4% of the wages that you're going to pay these new employees. And we let me backtrack. The original concept was one based on withholding, which we figured, as we listened to testimony, had a fair amount of problems with it. And so to avoid that and to avoid really working off of any definitive payroll figures in terms of trying to figure 50% of those, because you keep in mind the original concept of mine was to give back to the employer for a year half of the taxes the employee paid in. But what we've decided to do is shorten this to 6 months only. This whole program only runs for 6 months, and still kind of try to keep within that 50% of the taxes paid concept, conceptually. Well, I just achieve it a different way. And I achieve it a different way by just saying whatever wages you pay, whether they're to a minimum wage person or they're to an executive, those wages, 2.4% of those are what the employer for 6 months can claim as a tax credit. And that roughly equals, according to Dick Yates's figures, about half of the taxes that are paid. So that's basically the concept here. We also, in the Dash 5, are also very careful to make sure that you cannot purchase a company with employees that would qualify, and then because it's a new company that you bought, you'd be able to claim the tax credit. That's not the purpose or the intent of this legislation. The intent is to encourage employers to hire new employees, not reshuffle people through the deck. So we made that change, and that's basically on page 2 in paragraph 7. That Dexter had made that opportunity to do that. And basically the way this is written here, someone, and I am waiting to get clarification with Dexter on one issue, and that is in paragraph 7, it also says on line 22, a qualified employer is a new entity or acquired the business of. And it seems to imply to me that a new entity, a startup company, would not be eligible for the tax credit, and that is not my intention. And so I'm waiting for Dexter to perhaps give me some clarification on that. I understand that. Representative Hobson, your thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have that new entity underlined myself in a question here. Does this or does not this not include new businesses? And it seems to me that Section B, 3B, qualified employer means the employer who employed fewer than 50 full-time employees for the calendar year beginning January 1, 2002. It seems to me then that that would eliminate new businesses because they wouldn't have had any employees in 02.
Qualified employer means an employer who employed fewer than. So if you were an employer and you didn't have any full-time employees.
Mr. Chair, my question then would be, were you an employer? If you didn't have any employees, are you an employer?
That's an interesting. You want to come forward to hear from the unemployment department?
That's an interesting thought, actually.
Up, members of the committee. I'm Tamara Brickman, legislative coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department. And for tax purposes, I can't answer your question of whether or not a person with no employees is an employer. Under the Employment Department statute, there are specific definitions of what qualifies as employment for purposes of UI tax. So it would be individuals as they are employed by an employer, and that employer would be responsible for the unemployment insurance taxes. So I don't know that I can shed any light on the issue as it relates to the Department of Revenue's statutes or other statutes for purposes of employment.
Follow-up to that same thing, Mr. Chair, then. I guess the important point here is what your intent is. And if I'm understanding you correctly now, your intent is to have it include new startup companies.
Absolutely.
That would start January 1st.
That is correct. That is my intent, and I want this language to be fairly specific about it. Unless we're interpreting this incorrectly, Representative Lowe, you're a lawyer. You want to throw your 2 cents here?
I haven't paid my professional liability fund dues, which means that if I give you bum advice, you can't sue the bar.
Okay, so noted.
I think it does have the effect that I think it probably would have the effect of eliminating startup companies, but you're being very careful to lay the groundwork out here in a legislative history of this bill that it is not your intention to do so.
That is correct.
And so that helps a little bit. I have a question for you, however.
Certainly.
Now, we're saying that if, say, you have 50 employees and you hire 5 new people, then you get a tax break, a tax credit on 2.4% of the wages of 55 employees or on the 2.4% on the wages of 5 employees?
Great question, Representative. This is intended to and should be written in a manner that it only allows a tax credit for the new employees that qualify as part of the 10% or better that any employer would hire. So in your example, to be clear, the 50 employees that were previously hired the employer gets no tax credit based on their employment, but the new employees, the 5 that he would hire new, would in fact be eligible for the tax credit for 6 months.
To lay that out, make it clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a technical clarification. I actually think an employer with 50 employees would not qualify. It's fewer than, so it would be 49 employees. Just for technical clarification.
Actually, that you may be correct, Representative. Fewer than, so it, the word fewer implies it would have to be less than 50.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So 49 would be the limit there. And I'm frankly comfortable with that if the rest of you are. It's not an issue with me.
Now, I have another question.
Yes.
And it relates to the UI aspect of this. Would the overall effect of this bill be to diminish services to employees who lose their jobs? I mean, will it diminish the amount of money in the pot since we're giving it back to the employer?
I can only speak with respect to the unemployment insurance trust fund. With respect to the, I guess I'm not quite clear what your question is.
I'm not quite clear either. I want to be sure that nothing that we do diminishes funds available. Programs, funds available for programs to people of the state who lose their jobs. Well, we're diminishing some of the revenues.
Right.
Go to the state, and are we putting in jeopardy anything that's going to help, that should be used to help displaced workers?
It certainly is not my intention to do so, and I don't believe that we are, because the employers pay separately other than the taxes that the employee pays. The employer pays separately, depending on your classification. There are two classifications for unemployment insurance, as I understand it. One is the regular program where you as an employer pay pretty much a flat monthly fee into the unemployment insurance fund. That is outside of the taxes that are collected by by the state on your employees. If you are what's called self-insured as an employer, when one of your employees goes on, you lay them off and they go on unemployment, then you have to start writing a check every month for that full amount, or every week, depending on how it works, I guess, on what that employee is getting in terms of unemployment benefits. So as I understand it, and is my intent, that there nothing in this bill would keep the normal flow of money from employers to the unemployment insurance fund. It should not have any impact at all.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And members of the committee, as I've read the draft, it doesn't affect the unemployment insurance trust fund, and of course we'd run into some federal issues if we did. So my understanding is if somebody qualified for unemployment insurance, they would still qualify and be eligible for and receive unemployment insurance benefits regardless of this bill.
Okay. Dexter, do you have any thoughts to add on that if you'd like to come forward? We actually have some other questions for you also. So.
Well, yeah, and I have some more questions.
Sure, too. Absolutely.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon, Dexter Johnson, the bill is simply a credit against an employer's income tax. It doesn't affect unemployment taxes at all.
Okay. My other question, thank you, Dexter, is non-resident employer on page 3 at line 2. What's the reason about that? Supposing we have non-resident employers who locate a business operation in the state and import out-of-state workers to do this, to work here, so we're not really benefiting Oregonians with this tax break in any way. Is there somewhere around that?
Mr. Chair, actually, no. This issue came up earlier today in another context, but the U.S. Constitution requires that residents and non-residents be treated on an equal basis for taxes.
It's called the Commerce Clause. Yes, I know. But why then are we specifically making a reference to that in our bill here?
That is all of Section 9 is basically boilerplate that you'll find in virtually every income tax credit. It simply says that non-resident applies the proration that they apply to all of their other items of income, a part of your residence too. They apply the credit to that as well. So that if of your total income, 40% was attributable to Oregon sources, the credit would be reduced by 40%, for example. That's standard boilerplate language.
So, Dexter, in along that same line of Representative Lowe's question, then the non-resident employer comes in and employs, say, starts a branch office of some industrial supply company and hires 10 people. Those 10 people are going to pay Oregon taxes, correct? The employees are...
Yes, they will, whether or not they're residents, they will pay...
They will still pay...
Oregon taxes on the income that they are earned in Oregon from this job.
But the tax credit allowed under this bill would go to that non-resident employer for the six-month time period, and then that would be it, correct?
Yes.
Because
for that tax, right, the 2002 tax.
For that.
Or 2003 tax. Yes.
So the employees that are employed here, though, even though they, in fact, may be non-residents,
they
still, because they didn't come earned here in Oregon, they still have to pay Oregon taxes on them.
That's correct.
Okay. Which is the issue we have with the folks who live in Vancouver, drive across the bridge, and work in Portland.
Yeah, they pay Oregon.
They pay Oregon income tax.
On the income that they earn here in Oregon.
Representative, will you have additional questions? Well, I'm sure you will, and we'll just keep them here until we're all sort of satisfied. Actually, Dexter, I have a question for you. We wanted to be sure that on page 2, on paragraph 7, sub 7, there that on line 22, the words new entity... there's some concern that that may preclude a new business from starting up here in Oregon and taking advantage of this credit. Are we reading that incorrectly?
Mr. Chair, I don't think so. I mean, if the new entity, this paragraph would only apply if the new entity employed 50% or more employees from... that were all previously employed with an earlier employer.
Right.
So it was designed to address the concern of creating this new corporation, moving all the employees over to the new corporation and saying they're new employees.
The shuffling of the deck that we did not want to see with this kind of a concept. So then if you go back to page 1, and I think Representative Hobson brought this up, under line 12, I think during 12 and 13, the qualified employer means an employer who employed fewer than 50 full-time employees for the calendar year beginning January 1, 2002. Does that paragraph preclude a new business startup?
Sure, I don't think so, because it says fewer than 50 full-time employees. I see your point.
Yeah.
It does kind of read that you have to employ somebody.
Right. So if for instance, Dexter, if I were the mythical espresso stand that was doing my thing in the morning and I was the sole proprietor of that and I want to expand my hours and I hire somebody, then I've been in business, but I'm not an employer.
Right.
I'm working this as a sole proprietorship or something of that nature. So do you think then that we ought to perhaps clarify that?
Probably wouldn't hurt.
Yeah. Representative Hoffman.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Dexter, I would enter in some more discussion on line 21 on page 2, because I think the way it's worded, it says
in which the qualified employer is a new entity or acquired the business of a person. And if I heard your explanation correctly, I think what you meant would be is a new entity and acquired. No,
Representative Hopkins, you could either be an existing entity that then acquires the business. You could be an entity that's been around for 10 years and you acquire the business from the previous employer and all the employees move over. I don't think my understanding was they didn't, the chair did not want that employer to qualify for credit either. So it's either if you're a new entity and a whole bunch of employees move over, or you're an existing entity, but you take over the business of the previous employer. Either one of those will make you ineligible for credit.
Mr. Chiffon, but I think the way it's worded is you could actually put a period after new entity, and that isn't what you mean.
Well, there isn't a period after.
Right.
No, but if you have an or in there, you could have a period after that, or you could have the next clause, and they should have equal weight. They're not necessarily related. That's why I thought maybe you meant an and there, particularly in conjunction with the other one where we do need to reword the new entity piece. Anyhow, I know what you're saying, and I think what you mean. I'm not sure this says it this way.
Okay, well, we'll clarify that. Maybe break that up. Having 50% or more phrase go along with both new entities is repeated.
That would probably be correct. Captain Hoffman, any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do. I have one more on page 3, line 9, that whole paragraph. Is that the section that refers to people who did not last the full 6 months? The proration occurs for them. I'm reading this real quickly. I guess my main question is what happens to somebody who only works 3 months? Is that prorated, and how does the employer work into that?
You're talking about line 7 through 11.
Right. If a change in the taxable year of a taxpayer occurs.
I think this is where you have the situation where you have a taxable year that's less than 12 months. And you will prorate, again, the standard boilerplate language, you'll prorate the amount of the credit by the ratio of whatever the taxable year is to a full 12-month year.
Mr. Chair, perhaps it would be compared to the six-month period, since we're only dealing with a six-month potential period here.
6 months, which you can sure you hire employee, but the credit is an annual, is a tax year credit, because income taxes are reported generally on a 12-month tax year. There are some limited circumstances where, and it's really quite unusual, where you are required to have or choose to have a short taxable year. Those are fairly rare.
One follow-up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Please.
Just to make sure, I understand the tax year is a year, but my understanding is this will only be applicable for the months January of 2003 through June 30 of 2003.
In terms of qualifying, yes.
Gotcha.
Now,
sorry,
if you hypothetically on June 28th, you as an employer can meet the 10% criteria, and you decide to hire someone or two people or whatever, however many you need, you're then eligible for the credit because you made the deadline, but you're going to get that credit for the next 6 months. Okay, that's the intention here. Okay, so Dexter, you're going to clarify that language in terms of new entity?
In terms of new entity, that the 50% or more full-time employees phrase applies to both new entities and acquired businesses.
Right. And 50 full-time, if fewer than 50 full-time employees means 49 or less in action.
Yeah, including if you don't have any.
Right, right, including if you don't have any. Right, okay.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question of anybody who's in the room. Anybody who's in the room, probably the people that seated at the table can answer this best. But based upon how this thing is structured and what impact it has upon a business, what kind of business is most likely to take advantage of this? What kind of industry are we going to see stimulated because of this? Is this going to target or make attractive growth in any particular sector? Please help me understand how this is going to help.
Chair Representative Lowe, other than the requirement that it be a small employer with 50 employees or less, it's open to anyone. So there isn't particularly, so you're talking small businesses, but other than that, no one particular sector of the economy is targeted.
I think the answer is restaurants.
I was thinking wrong. I frankly was thinking especially farmers. I wasn't thinking restaurants at all. I just thought it didn't cross my mind.
You have to have earnings, Representative.
You have to have a what?
Earnings.
Oh, that's true. So I guess that precludes farming.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lowe, I'd be happy to check with our labor market information folks to see if they have any information on what the, in breaking down those types, that with that number of employees, what types of businesses are there out there. I'd be happy to, I'd be what I can come up with
that. That actually would be, that's a great idea, good question, Representative Lowe, because that I think would be helpful information and just sort of giving us some concept of who's going to really be utilizing this.
Okay.
If our intention, members, to stimulate small business with us. This is why we originally started at 100 and we came down to 50 because we thought that the real benefit, and let me backtrack. A large company typically has an economic model of business that isn't going to be dependent on an idea like this. But the little hardware store down the road, the espresso stand, those kind of folks that are kind of right on the edge, if they can get a little help here to get started, they're going to be the ones, I think, that are going to look at this and say, you know what? Yeah, you know, that I'll make that decision to hire that person earlier than I would have because I'm going to get some of it back and it's going to help pay for them. And that's why we wanted to target this to a smaller group of people because we think that's where the impact will be most positive. But it'd be great if you could give us that information.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to check and see if you have that information available, and I will...
And Representative King, the Restaurant Association has no clue I'm doing this.
I'll let them know.
Thank you. Any further questions, members of Dexter, in terms of clarifying language? We allow rulemaking authority in the Department of Revenue to do whatever they need to do to file a form that the Department of Revenue would design for this. It could be nothing more than a checkoff on an existing form or whatever.
Mr. Chair, yeah, they, independent of the bill, they have rulemaking authority to do that.
Okay.
Rulemaking authority in here is specifically directed at identifying qualified employees.
Okay, and my last question, if I could please. How big of a hole does this put in the budget? Does this have a negative impact on revenues? I'm trying to understand.
It does.
Okay. Help me read this thing.
Well, I'll be happy to. And actually, Dick Yates, if you're listening, and I hope that you are, if you want to come on up and help us walk through this. Now, I had Dick prepare this particular document you see, and this is the one that has the little box that says 2.4% in it.
If you see the one that says 4%, discard it, because it's not the direction we're going. The top line members that says number one is kind of, this is kind of Dick's formula as to how he put all of this together. He ran a computer program on this. These are firms with 50 or fewer than 50 employees, and they have to have a growth eligibility of 10%. They have to have hired 10% more employees than they had previously to be eligible. If you look under, and it gives you the eligible firms of 3430, the credit base means that those are the numbers that Paul Warner is projecting of net increase in employment in this six-month time period that we're talking about here. That is without this legislation having any impact. Okay, so that's just the numbers that he's predicting right now. And then you move to the next line under induced growth, where it says eligible firms, 200. They believe that 200 firms will qualify under this criteria of less than 50 employees and 10% growth in employee numbers. The next number is 573. And since, Dick, you're here, why don't you come on up? And we'll provide you with a copy. Nancy, can you give him a copy of his computation for me, please? The next number is the number that Dick's economic model predicted would be the increase in jobs with this legislation. In other words, the net increase in jobs that we would have if we pass this legislation and become law. So then the total firms of what they were predicting originally and the eligible firms based on the tax credit brings us to 3,630. And the credit base means the total number of employees, 3,906. So basically, we're adding pretty close to 600 employees based on his model and based on the functioning of this tax credit. Did I describe that correctly, Dick?
I think you did an excellent job, Mr. Chair. Richard Yates, Legislative Revenue Office. You asked me this morning to change the credit percent from 4 to 2.4, which I did in this worksheet.
Yes.
Being somewhat distracted. That also determines the effect on employment because it's the wage rate reduction for the employer. So I have to rerun the whole model, which I didn't do. So these are a little bit overstated.
Oh.
There's not that much difference.
Okay. Overstated in what respect?
In terms of the induced growth, because I'm using an employment elasticity of 1.2% roughly.
Okay.
And that will drop, and that's based on 4% wage rate reduction. When you drop it down to 2.4, that gets a little smaller. So it's going to induce less, a little bit less employment. But the numbers are not that far off, I don't think. I just ran the first one, and I think it's fairly similar. But I'll rerun those for you.
Okay.
But basically, you know, what you said is correct. You offer a tax credit to an employer if he hires additional people. Now, you're only offering it to a select set of people, that those people who, one, are in a firm under size 50, the beginning of the period, and two, who's going to experience at least a 10% increase in employment. So that subset of employers, there's a further incentive for them to employ more people, and that is a tax credit, which reduces the cost of hiring additional people. So that's what the model is based on, is going in and build potentially a whole data set of firms. I don't really have a real data set, I have to manufacture one. And I use some, you know, statistical techniques essentially to build a distribution and then grow the individual firms in that distribution subject to a random distribution growth rate. And so I get, and that's why there's so many options here on this. The growth shock there may be kind of hard to interpret as you look at it three times, n parentheses 0, 1, that's three times the standard normal distribution, which has mean zero and standard deviation one. So what that's saying is I take that rate of growth that's occurring for those firms over that six-month period and multiply that by a variable, which actually, you know, varies between plus and minus infinity, but is very concentrated at the center, and the center is zero. So effectively, it's not changing the growth rate a lot, and it may reduce it, or it may increase it. So you have firms decreasing size, you have firms increasing in size. And then the weight that I use, the 3, 4, and 5, flattens out that distribution. So you have, in the case of 3, a fairly narrow distribution, and in the case of 5 there, you've flattened out the distribution, so you have a lot of variability. You've got firms declining by 10%, firms increasing by 10%. So that sort of did those other ones for my own benefit. And I think probably the factor of 3 there is more in line with what we can expect. So anyway, you shock these firms and you get some growing and you get others shrinking. And then you simply go through and you say, okay, when that firm began under 50 employees, and 2, did its growth exceed 10%? And if it did, then you count the tax credits there, essentially, are for all firms, not just those under 50, but all firms that experience growth. Again, if that firm meets the criteria, it's under 50, and its growth exceeded 10%, then it's eligible for the tax credit. And I divide that credit into 2 things. One, which would be the normal growth, the 10%, and then the induced growth over and above the 10%. And that's how I generate the numbers, essentially.
And Dick, your the average wage, and this is the statewide average of 33.3?
Yes.
And
it's out of the forecast for not manufacturing, but what's the other category? Not farming, no. It's salespeople, essentially.
Service.
Yeah, clerical salespeople. Okay.
Now, for firms, and this is actually a question for the employment department is, we were talking about what kind of firms would be under 50.
Mm-hmm.
What are the industrial makeups? What kind of companies are they? What industries are they in? Dick, would that, if they were all, if they were predominantly like restaurants and things like that, how would that change the wage average? Would it weight it differently?
Well, I've not seen the amendments, and I'm not sure. You know, I've sort of worked off concepts in developing this. So the credit is 4% of what, or 2.4% of what?
Of whatever they're paying.
Paying those individuals, those new employees?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So would that be?
The wages are actually paid.
Okay. Well, yes, obviously it would make a difference. I think initially we started talking about the average wage for the firm, and so that's why I was unsure. But obviously it would make a difference if they're employing people who are in general coming in under the wage rate that they're paying most of their employees.
Yeah.
That would, you know, it's a two-bladed sword, because one, you're generating less taxable income if you're inducing the employment. But also there'd be less credit cost.
Right, exactly. So the relationship, though, is probably going to stay fairly constant, I would think, in terms of
yeah.
the actual numbers. If it turned out that the average wage was $28,000, the amount of taxes that are paid will be commensurate with that, as so will be the tax credit.
Yeah,
probably not going to see great variability in your overall numbers.
I think the lower the wage, the more costly it would be, because at the low end, at least, Oregon's tax structure is a little bit progressive.
That's true.
So you're going to have a more rapid increase in tax payments. You know, and the opposite is true. If the wages tend to be higher, then you're going to have, you're going to produce more taxable income per dollar credit.
Right.
Right. Okay. So, in Representative Lowe, in answer to your question, if you then move to Dick, explain your first line here under credit. Okay, column one says firms eligible, and that is firms whose employment at the beginning of the period is less than or equal to 50 employees. The shock is simply the variability in growth among those firms. And I don't know how to quantify that for you. Well, there is over here kind of down in this lower portion, I tried to quantify it a little bit. With the standard normal distribution, this would say that 68% of the firms are growing within the range of plus and minus 7%. Okay, so you've got a tail out there on each end. We're growing or shrinking by more than 7%. The next column is growth eligibility, and that says that that the growth in employment has to exceed 10% of their base growth, base employment. The next one says, well, is there a limit on the base? And in this case, the top line, there is none. So if they meet the criteria, all employees, all increased employment qualifies. To sort of compare that with the one below it, if you look at line two, it says greater than 10%. That would mean if you expanded employment, say, by 15%, you would get to use as a base of computing the credit only that 5% in excess of 10%. You would not get the full amount. This says that under normal growth assumptions, without shocking the model for the inducement, you get 3,430 firms that would be affected. They would have growth in excess of 10% and have employment under 50. And the credit amount would be, the credit base is the increase in employment. So you've got actually just barely over one per firm there. You've got 3,400 right. firms and you're getting 3,000 employees. Then you increase, for those that are meeting the criteria, you reduce the wage cost to those firms and increase their employment because of the reduced wage. You add another 200 firms. So there would be 200 firms that would get the credit. But, and the amount of those would be essentially 573 full-time employees. Now, the 573 creates an additional credit cost, but it also generates income because this is new employment. And we're assuming these new people will be paying taxes. And if their average salary is $33,300, they'll pay $1,598.40 in tax on average.
Yes, Representative Lowe.
Thank you. Richard, let me interpose a question here. I'm trying to compare this in my mind to what I know happened back in the 60s. God, am I dating myself. With the CETA program, and one of the eligibility criteria for that, for an employer under that particular program, you weren't born yet, Jeff.
Yes, I was. I'm a 50s child. Not by much.
Susan Mark, man.
I'm a 40s child, so this is deep.
Don't age yourself.
Yeah. Anyway.
Want to try 30s?
Julie, you're at 20. So, was that the person hired had to have been long-term unemployed for a period of time.
Uh-huh.
So as I'm listening to how you arrive at your figures, I don't see in this anywhere a negation of the assumption that this is somebody who was long-term unemployed, because these figures aren't going to be the same if you're simply going to change your job. If you're a previously employed person somewhere and you simply change your job to this new business that has this incentive going for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not figured into the overall tax impact.
It would be in the sense that for all those firms that don't meet the 10% growth requirement, you've got that normal activity going on anyway. You've got, you know, employees moving back and forth among firms. Some will be growing, some will be shrinking. And in this case, it wouldn't affect the credits because they're not meeting either of those two or both of those criteria, that the firm be under 50 and that they have more than 10% growth. Now, I have no way of distinguishing when a firm in my model, of course, it's not reality, it's a fun little program, when a firm grows sufficiently to meet these criteria, it's because it, you know, got shocked randomly. And I have no idea where that employee comes from, whether he might come from off of unemployment or from the firm next door or wherever. And I would not know how to estimate, you know, the proportion that would be coming off of unemployment.
Would it be I was distracted by the Saints marching in, but
I guess if I can just comment one more note, as I think about that question, if you are inducing employment, whether that person comes off of unemployment who is hired by that firm, you're creating more demand for labor. And so you're probably, you know, that's got to come from somewhere. It might be people immigrating into Oregon, or it might be people joining the workforce for the first time or whatever, or it might be people coming off of unemployment. But you are generating increased demand for labor. And so that should tend, you know, in a sense, to draw some people off of unemployment.
My concern is the overall impact on the general revenue available to the state of Oregon by getting this tax credit. What we really want to do is help stimulate the overall Oregon economy, so we would really like to target new hires or people coming off of the unemployment rolls rather than encourage, say, rating of one small tech firm of the talents of another small tech firm and then getting the benefits, you know, everybody playing fruit basket upset. So how do we target it more specifically, and can we? I think we can. We certainly did in the 60s in the DeSita program. Target it to employers who hire people who have been unemployed for 6 months or so. 3 months.
We actually talked about that, and was it, Dexter, did you and I talk about, Dick, it must have been you and I talking about unemployment and how we could target that, and there might be some actually discriminatory effects on some employers wanting to take advantage of the tax credit, and maybe the person they wanted to hire was qualified for the job, was maybe not even on unemployment, maybe had run out of their 26 weeks or whatever. And you wouldn't necessarily want to, and I frankly wrestled with that, and I just thought overall it would be better for us to make this available to everyone to really get the ball rolling correctly. I got to thinking, well, how could we target it? Just employers who went out and hired people who came off the unemployment rolls. And, you know, the more I got thinking about it, the more complex this bill got. Because and one of the questions that we've wrestled with here is how do you delineate between people who are going to hire people anyway and people who are going to hire based on our little tax credit here. And we thought how we could do that through OECDD, make applications through them. And the more we talked about that, the more complicated we made this piece of legislation. And ultimately, I opted to think, well, maybe we ought to just try and keep it a little simpler. But I'll ask that question of the employment department. Is there some way to target this thing to only unemployed individuals that would come off the unemployment roll? It still doesn't help us with the general fund issue of a revenue impact. But it certainly does help in the total fund budget because employers that are self-insured
and not going to be writing that check every month for unemployment insurance.
Actually, the truth is that it does help the general fund issue by bringing more people into income tax paying status.
Right.
That we're bringing new people into income tax paying status. We're not just having a tax credit on top of people who would already otherwise be paying income tax.
Right.
That's one of the things that I'm concerned about, is that the effect on the, if we really want this to have a be a wash, as you say, then you better target it a little more closely to people who have been long-term unemployed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, short of like the drafting that would be necessary to do that, I didn't want to comment on that, and I don't know whether or not legally there would be ramifications for targeting hiring for certain individuals. So one thing that comes into my mind would be maybe the administrative issues that surround that, and that would be verification of whether a person was unemployed, how the employer would verify that that person came on to their payroll from the from unemployment insurance. And so there are some issues that would relate to that, and then you get into confidentiality issues of whether or not that information can be available to employers. But I don't know personally how you would structure that that incentive into a piece of legislation. I'd be happy to work with Dexter on coming up with ideas of how we might be able to do that.
Fair representative, well, with the exception of the kind of administrative concerns of the camera rate, I think legally, this is all off the top of my head, legally I wouldn't think there would be a problem with simply putting a requirement in there that in order to be a qualified employee, in addition to the other, in addition to being hired between January and July, you need to have been unemployed and claiming employment benefits for a certain period of time. I think administratively how that would be able to be managed might be difficult.
Actually, I don't think it would be difficult at all. All the employer would have to do is certify that it's true and then sign something that it's true that these people were long-term unemployed.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Representative Lowe, just to follow up on that line of thought, then if the employer is certifying that the new employees were on unemployment prior to coming into their employ, how would that employer verify from those individuals? Would then the individual need to sign a statement?
The individual would need to sign a statement.
Would they need to be only coming through the unemployment department? And if so, what kind of a fiscal impact does that have for your agency?
If I could add on to that.
Yeah.
I'd raise my hand up. What starts to develop here when you go to the next step is the prospect of a little bit of a turf war. Clearly if the prospect was gained from the employment department's list of eligible beneficiaries, then you clarified that you are hiring people who are unemployed and were paying unemployment insurance benefits to. But then that means that the employment division is in direct competition with a private sector employment agency who might be trying to place people in those same jobs. And so you are adding a layer of competition for placing those placements in favor of the division is versus private sector. I had another issue later, but I'll wait until my turn for questions.
Good point.
Mr. Chair, as well, also following up on that, the other issue that just comes to my mind is that issue that the chair mentioned with respect to, do you have to be actively receiving unemployment insurance, or could you have exhausted your benefits, meaning you're not receiving anything at this current time, you just happen to be unemployed. And not eligible for benefits because you haven't worked to give yourself a base in order to collect benefits. So that would be another issue that would probably need to be clarified in the...
Well, or certainly have been absent from the job market for a while. You have to be a new hire. I know a lot of people who have lost their jobs and would be eligible for unemployment compensation, but who don't feel comfortable in accepting unemployment compensation and do without it. So those folks would be eligible too, in my mind.
So you, what we're saying with Representative Lowe is it wouldn't necessarily have to be someone who...
No.
But it would. Your point is it ought to be a new hire, someone who's not currently working for anyone else.
Trying to increase the number of jobs.
Right, right.
See, one of the other things that I know about the technical, I don't know all there is about the tech industry, but they rate each other a lot.
Sure.
And why should we just allow them to play fruit basket upset with their employees and get a tax break when what we really want to do is stimulate the economy?
Well, but you have to keep in mind that, either way, this concept is you're creating new jobs. You can't just be trading employees because you have to have an increase in the number of employees to qualify.
Well, the one business says that somewhere down the line, here's this low-tech industry and all 30 of their employees have been hired away by high-tech industry and you don't have a net increase in jobs because Lowe's out and high's in. And
yeah, but doesn't Lowe have to replace the people that got hired away?
Oh, well, Lowe may go under.
Well, but see, that's all part of Dick's model of the shock value of some are contracting, some are expanding. I'm not sure how we get at that. Can you say something?
Oh, I was actually just clearing my throat, I guess.
Okay.
They weren't mutually exclusive.
What about using the same mechanism as Jobs Plus? I've hired two gals in my legislative office under the Jobs Plus program, which I have one of them has worked out really well, and the other one didn't work out so good. But had she stayed off the wagon, it would have worked out great. Never mind, because I haven't said any names, but it's the Jobs Plus program is a great program, and it's welfare to work, and it's a marvelous opportunity to get people off the welfare rolls and help them gain the skills that they need to become more marketable and employable. And of course, Jobs Plus is in essence not in existence any longer, but is that a mechanism? Well, in terms of any, they're not accepting any new individuals into the job. So does that mechanism of Job Plus?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what mechanism. I'm not sure how you would utilize that to provide incentives.
Well, Jobs Plus is a state and a federal matching kind of a program. In this case, we're talking about maybe the same thing we were talking about before, is trying to identify people who are off of work and making this credit available to them.
Mr. Chair, under Jobs Plus, as you are probably aware, in order to identify those individuals that are eligible for those UI recipients, unemployment insurance recipients that are eligible for the program, they have to be identified in our office within the employment department as likely to exhaust their benefits. Those are the individuals that they usually look to in order to refer them out to Jobs Plus jobs. I'm not sure how you would utilize, and that's in place. The individual then goes to work in place of receiving benefits.
Correct.
Can we say that somebody who's been unemployed for at least 30 days?
How many days?
30 days.
Dexter, from a legal perspective, is...
Sure, you could say that, and as Representative Lowe just have each individual affirm that that is, as you say, in the credit application process.
Representative Lowe, I don't have any problems with that at all. I think that's...
Will you direct staff to make an amendment to that effect?
Well, yeah, I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Is that clear? We'll go to discussion on that.
Well, yes. Representative King.
I understand where you're going, but one of the concerns I have about the bill, and I did share with the chair that, this looks like a bill, as far as I can see, that I'm not able to support. But I certainly appreciate the effort he's putting into trying to do the right thing with this bill. But I think one of the things that you get into here is a lot of social policy engineering, which I think your question addresses as saying, well, I want to employ the unemployed people rather than the employed people. But a whole bunch of folks, like you have said, are going to be employed, and they go to the new employer, and the old employer hires folks. So you do have that increase. There's certainly the possibility to hire away a key employee, and you end up, because of that, killing a company off. But I think that you do end up with a whole myriad of social engineering issues when you start addressing these questions that, where do you stop and how far can you go, or are you willing to go? Another pretty substantial concern I have here is the prospect for windfall benefits to greatly outweigh the targeted benefits. There's a great likelihood here that seasonal employment, tourism, recreation, those who depend on those things, really land in a circumstance where they weren't, there on December 31st, but they were, hired from, March through September, and get their 6 months in, and so all those people then, generate some tax credits when they would have been employed anyway. And going back to, our original meeting where the construction industry was, is kind of designed to do an awful lot of work for a period of time, but they're not there on December 31st. So again, we end up with the prospect for a lot of windfall benefit to employers, and that's a net revenue loss to the state without generating any net, real economic activity benefit. And I'm not seeing any way around that.
No, that is a problem.
And another aspect is that you could have 45 employees, at the beginning of a year, and in the hire and fire and turnover process, that you end up with 10 new employees or 20 new employees in the next year, but still end up with starting with 45 and ending up with let's say starting at 44 and ending up with 49, and you get your 10%, but you're getting a benefit of a turnover of potentially 15 employees in the process. I realize that there's a cap of 9%, but you're paying out more to get a net benefit than I think is the intent of what you're trying to accomplish here. So you just keep running into a lot of problems.
Actually, the way this is there, Dexter and I went over that, because the seasonal employment of some businesses is such that you wouldn't want a business that isn't the intent of this legislation to allow a company to take a tax employer to take a tax credit on the seasonal hiring that they would normally experience. So it's actually written such, and we just went over this morning, Dexter, I did, the language of this, that you have to compute what your average is over the whole year.
I understand that was a draft, and I heard that as a concept. I'm not seeing that in arithmetic or dash five.
Well,
what I'm seeing here is you got a starting balance and ending balance, and it was not the average employees for 2002. It was the calendar date.
Okay. Page 2, Representative, if you look at sub 6, Dexter and I talked about that in our first meeting this morning. Basically says, if you read line 19 starting there, the number of full-time employees of the employer by at least 10% from the previous tax year. It implies you have to average
Dexter says it implies you have to average it.
Well, unfortunately, he just left. I don't think that this says that any longer.
Would you like me to put language in there that clarifies that?
I think it's important.
Because I don't have a problem doing that for you.
I don't think there's anything implied in that. And then you go back to page 1, and I think it's line 12b. Qualified employer means employer who employed fewer than 50 full-time employees for the calendar year beginning January 1, 02. And then you go over to, I think you were saying on page 2, paragraph number 6. Does not expand by at least 10%. Well, that to me means that, you know, in that example, if you have, I don't think you can get over 50 and be qualified. So, you know, let's say you have 44, maybe that's the maximum size you can have, and you add 5 people, that's more than 10%. You end up with an ending employment balance of 49, and so that person would qualify.
Agreed.
It didn't have anything to do with it, with the average. So you could have had a employer go have 200 employees on July 15th and end up with December 31st, 2002 with 44 because you're seasonal and you're qualified according to paragraph C.
So your opinion is, Representative, that we should clarify that it has to be an average of fewer than 50.
I understand now that's your intent. I heard that intent before.
Okay. You like using language to make you feel more comfortable.
Well, I don't know if we did there, but I think that that's satisfying your intent, and I'm saying that I don't see it in the reading now, and we got a couple of wise heads sitting there that are used to seeing these. They might have an opinion. The wise head in front of the sticker as versus the wise head back here. Being the third one, the wise head. Okay. You're not included.
Well, I don't have a problem doing that. Let's go back to the concept of if we're going to try and target this thing, Representative. And you disagree with Representative Lowe in terms of somebody has to be unemployed for 30 days to qualify as an employee that the employer can hire.
That's true. I think we'd probably get a better benefit by not doing that. But I, in addition to that, and I think there's justified opinions on both sides. I'm not arguing that strongly. I think that that it doesn't matter. It's probably a better policy. But I also have a concern, and I also think understand some of the philosophy that I've heard you espouse that are Jeffersonian in nature about how much social engineering do you want to get into here? And I'm saying that, you know, it's likely you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound the farther you go here.
That's a good point.
Nancy, excuse.
Yes. One last thing. Explain to us the under credit tax and impact.
Okay. Yes. Once you have a credit base, you're really talking about numbers of employees that are eligible. To get at the amount of the credit, what I've done is to take 4%, or 2.4% in this case, of the average wage, which is $800. So that's the credit for employee, and multiply that then by the number of credits. So 800 times, if you're dealing with the first case, 3,906 is the total number of credits, gives you a number somewhere around 3 million, I guess. And then I've said, okay, only 90% of that is going to actually make it to the Department of Revenue with a credit. Either the employer is not going to bother with it, not know it's available, or for whatever reason, they're not going to claim it on the return. They may not have any taxable income. So then multiplying that by 0.9 gets you to a total cost of the credit of $2,812,320. Okay, that's where that first number comes from. The second number then deals with the amount of induced credit, induced growth. So you would have, in this case, in the first line, 573 who are in the credit base because of induced growth. Okay, that's the third from the last column at the top of the sheet, 573 people. You would multiply that number of people by a tax per induced employee of 1,598.4. And then I've applied a multiplier of 1.2 to take into consideration, again, the dynamic effects on the economy. Once you induce in growth in the economy, you've generated income, and there is a multiplier effect. Now, that multiplier is pretty low, and that's because I expect most of these jobs to be in what we call the domestic or Oregon market, not in export markets. You really get a multiplier when you're in an export market. So I've assumed essentially about 20% of the induced growth would be in the export market, and that's why you get a multiplier of 1.2. So multiplying the 1598 by 1.2 and then by the number of induced growth employees gives you, in that first case, a induced tax of $1,099,000. Subtracting those two gives you the revenue impact. In this case, your credits exceed the tax generated by $1,700,000.
Okay. Okay. And that's the effect on the general fund?
Yes.
Okay. And how would these numbers change if the job growth was a little flatter than what you'd predicted?
They go down.
Okay.
They go down because of your requirement that they exceed 10%. So if you have less variability in the growth of firms, less are going to meet that 10% requirement.
So both numbers go down. Both the numbers of new jobs
yes.
created or?
Yes, both.
Okay. Because there will be less firms that will be eligible because
right.
growth just will not quite be the extent that we thought it would be.
There will be less employers who would qualify for the credit and therefore have an incentive to employ more.
Okay,
one question. I know you're probably anxious to get down and get to work, Richard, but if I could ask you one more question. Okay, we've tried 4%, we've tried 2.4%. At what, is there a number, a credit number that we could use where it's a wash?
No, I don't think so. Conceptually, and that bothers me, of course, if you look at the second row in the table here, there is a positive number, but that's because I didn't adjust the induced employment effects. I mean, the idea of you can get something for nothing doesn't wash, all right? You get some dynamic feedback. I mean, if we looked at this program in the way we have, say, two or three sessions ago, the only thing you get is an estimate of the number of credits and the costs without any induced or dynamic sort of considerations. But you don't, in general, by reducing taxes, stimulate the economy enough to end up with more money. There isn't a way we've found to do that yet. So it's going to cost you something. You reduce the cost, in this case, by the 10% threshold, because of all those firms that would be growing out there anyway and would be eligible without that 10%, you eliminate most of them. But then you also eliminate some where they might have responded to a tax inducement. So there is no break-even number.
The policy question for us is to decide if we're willing to make an investment of $1.7 million to get 573 people to work
right.
earlier than they would have been. That's what it boils down to. And then what extra societal effects are, if there are some that are on unemployment that go off of unemployment, some that are on food stamps and that come off of food stamps and those types of issues. That's the question there. Any further questions for Dick so he can get back to his important work also? Thanks, Dick.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Any further questions of Tamara? Yes, you do, don't you?
No,
are you good to go?
I was just going to say thank you, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And I'll see about getting that information this afternoon.
Yeah, it would really be very helpful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Sounds like we better have a policy discussion.
But absolutely, and that's what this is. This is all leading that direction. Any further testimony from the audience? Welcome our FFA members. Where are you from?
I'm really on the FFA State Officer Team. So I'm from Pineville, Oregon.
I'm from Lakeview.
I'm from
Sandfield.
I'm from Jordan
Valley. And I'm the program coordinator and living in Dallas.
Great. Well, welcome. Glad to have you all here. My mother lives just 5 miles outside of Prineville off of Johnson Creek Road. I love it out there. I love to get out there and get away from the valley and relax and get away from politics on occasion.
And you should go see your mother more often.
I should go see my mother. Yeah. Representative, you are so, so correct. Harvey, do you have anything you want to add to our discussion here today other than what you did this morning? No, on this, on 4072. Okay. Deborah, you just walked in. It's great to have you here. I know you've been involved in the other hearings. We're sort of at the place where we're going to probably adjust our amendments a little bit further here and then have a further policy discussion. So that's kind of where we're at on it. So if you have nothing else to add, members, what are your thoughts here with what we're trying to achieve? I'm open to your thoughts. We're here to have a policy discussion. Let's talk about it. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As an overall judgment of it, I'm very uncomfortable moving forward to some of the tangential areas and issues when I'm so pressured into feeling we're here to balance the budget. I think there certainly is some merit here, and I appreciate the policy discussions because both of my colleagues here with the different ideas, it's very provocative because I do have some concerns that this kind of a program, because it certainly has some merit, doesn't just impact the service areas. I think that there's some real potential here because you talk about 50 and 49 or fewer employees, some of those are fairly good-sized companies. We're not talking solely about mom and pop, and we're not solely talking about service areas in that I think there's a lot of high-tech companies that start out with 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever. So I think we need to look at it broad-based. I also am very cognizant of the fact that when you're talking 10% growth, we're really talking at least 20% of the categories that you have listed there, because it only takes one person to have met that one criteria. So I think there's some merit in all that being said. My inclination is not to support it because I don't want to, for lack of a better word, muddy up the waters on what our focus is here. I feel very limited and very directed on what I see as our mission here in this special session. There's just too many unanswered questions, too, as I think we keep generating more and more of them. And I get a little worried when I heard the discussion on to whom this should actually apply, that there are going to be amendments made that will jiggle it the other way from what I see as problematic on either side of that continuum.
Okay, thank you. Listen, Jane.
It would be easier to look at this bill or policy as an economic stimulation experiment when we're in a circumstance where we're not cutting the budget. And then to find out, are we putting $1 million of risk on the table, or are we finding that there's $37 million on the table because, there's seasonal is bigger than we thought. or there were unanticipated consequences. You know, and since we're not in a revenue surplus mode, you know, I'm certainly more prone to play defense, you know, than offense on that circumstance. So I think what might be a worthwhile economic, at least experiment, if not good policy, I'd really be reluctant, you know, in today's environment to try and get there. I do think, however, that the other policies that we're taking a look at with Representative Butler's bill has a circumstance of, you know, having no dollars on the table that we lose from current revenue, and have you know, a dramatically bigger bang for a dramatically longer period of time. You know, if any of those events were to transpire positively, and there's no assurance of that, but if we brought one venture capitalist into the state that, you know, had $100 million in portfolio value and was applying $40 million per year and attracted another $40 million or $80 million behind that, you know, that could conceivably be, you know, 1,000, 2,000 employees, and 5 years down the road, you're talking about, you know, multiple spinoff investments, and you do it for 30 years. I mean, it's mind-boggling on something that potentially didn't cost us 5 cents out of today's budget. So I think that I find more fruit potentially in the other policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, of course, the reason we're in this building is because of the lousy economy and the loss of jobs, and which is, when you read the headlines last week, and apparently not getting a whole lot better for right now. And, you know, the difference between this bill that we've been talking about here now and the one that was brought by the other major dealing with the investment capital coming into the state is like talking about someone that's trying to hit a single and someone who's trying to hit a home run, you know. And what I've seen, especially with the Mariners recently, whenever they take a great big swing, you get that home run, they end up with nothing. And I think that, you know, even though it's obvious that there's a lot of difficulty in trying to work your bill through, any effort to to enhance employment opportunities now within the state of Oregon needs to have due consideration. And I would encourage you to still continue the effort, and hopefully we can come out with a bill that will work.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. Members, I guess my perspective on this that I would ask you to consider is Representative Lowe, you haven't said anything, so please.
Well, I'm willing to risk a little of the general fund, but I'm not willing to risk a lot of the general fund at this point. I'm a little concerned about some of the scenarios Richard has left us, but there are some calculations under which we end up with an 8, maybe almost $9 million dollar impact. And every penny counts these days when we're trying to keep mental health and funded and so on. So I guess we need to keep massaging these numbers, I think, before I could...
That's actually a good point, because it's a little confusing, because if you look at up on the top columns under scenario number 5, it shows eligible firms at 12,000 when we have eligible firms of what we really think it's going to be at 3,400. And I think that's his changes in his computer program for how many firms are contracting, how many are expanding, you know, the different variabilities there. And I've looked at the revenue, or not the revenue forecast, but the employment forecast for 2003, and it's a pretty straight up line if you look at it on the chart. And I personally am not confident that we're going to see that rapid increase in employment. And not being an economist and not knowing how to track those things, I'm not going to second guess Paul Warner and Dick Yates on those numbers.
And that's why I asked him the question, how would things change if we have less employment than what they're forecasting as the baseline? And then will this tax credit have a more positive impact if you have less employment than what they had originally forecasted? And the formula that Dick uses takes some of that into account.
I guess what I'm really saying, Mr. Chair, is that I think the idea is noble to try and generate jobs and help businesses grow because I really do believe that that's a good thing to do. It's just that I'm wondering if we're going about it in such a way that we shoot our state recovery in the foot. And I don't want to shoot ourselves in the foot. I don't mind shooting off a little toe, but no, but I think this would be bad. You can have a toenail. But when we're not able to provide mental health services and we're releasing prisoners from jail, $1 million can go a long way towards rehabilitating an incarcerated youth.
Well, it clearly does, Representative, and I appreciate your comments and all of your comments because they are certainly well taken. The two things I would ask you to consider are this. This is our fifth special session, and we as a body have done nothing to stimulate our economy. Absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a missed opportunity, frankly, because had we had more direction, had it been more of our direction as a body to not only rebalance our budget in the first special session, but to find some ways to stimulate the economy. Typically, a stimulation of an economy means, like Dick was talking about, some kind of an incentive. And that's why we have enterprise zones, which in some areas of this state have worked phenomenally well. I give you the example of my former constituent hometown of Harrisburg, where we've had really a marvelous impact of an enterprise zone there, an industrial zone, in terms of employment in the town. So our problem is articulated by Representative Brown is we have this issue of less revenue because we have a faltering economy and less jobs. So there has to be an investment. We talk a lot about making the investment in education, something very dear to your heart, Representative Hobson. And we're looking for a longer-term benefit of that investment in education for our society as a whole, both on a societal aspect, but also on an economic aspect. So we talk a lot about the services that we deliver as a state to the vulnerable populations that we have and things that we think are really important, like my Oak Creek Youth Correctional Facility in Albany that may close, that has had, frankly, a very good impact in the lowering of juvenile crime in my county. Those are all important policy questions that we make choices on in our budget. But we can't fund any of those things. We can't fund K-12. We can't take care of senior citizens and do any of those things or hire enough state police to keep us safe in the age of terrorism in Ashley and Miranda. We can't do any of that unless we have a strong economy. We won't have the tax revenues to do those things. So that's why I'm asking you to join me and consider that we have to invest a little bit. And I'm looking at this $1.7 million impact as an investment. Keep in mind, it's only for 6 months. And then those jobs that have been created, and keep in mind, these have to be full-time jobs. And the whole concept here is that these people are going to continue working and providing additional revenue to the state down the road. And the second thing I'd ask you to consider is that this does have, I think, a positive societal impact in that we get people who are maybe unemployed, who are on unemployment, maybe on food stamps, or maybe not on unemployment, maybe just past their 26 weeks and frustrated and maybe leading to issues, which is a big problem in one particular area of my district, of a lot of domestic abuse. I know that's been an issue that's been very dear to your heart for a long time, Representative Lowe. Because when people are frustrated and are economically challenged at times, sometimes they don't always exhibit the proper behaviors towards the people that they love, and they end up with problems. So you have a societal impact. If we can reduce those numbers of circumstances and situations by providing a few extra jobs, if we can reduce people getting some folks off of cash assistance and welfare and off the unemployment rolls, then I think we've done a good thing. And I think here's an opportunity for us to do just exactly that. Yeah, it's 1.7, but I would ask you, think of it as an investment now to help stimulate our economy now, today.
Where does that money go, Mr. Chair? Where does the money go? Does it go into the pocket of the employer?
It reduces the cost of the employee to the employer, and they look at that potential rebate, if you will, to say, yeah, I mean, that's I'm going to hire somebody because this helps me make that decision to do that.
So by, I'm a Democrat, yes. Speak slowly and explain this. Drop it to the employer. Thank you. Explain it to me how that stimulates the economy.
Well, the employer will do two things with that money. They'll either reinvest it in their business by spending it in the economy, and there's a multiplier there that hasn't been taken into account. Okay. And the other multiplier is that employer now has $1.7 million more of taxable income of all of those employers, of which the state of Oregon, depending on what kind of a entity they are, whether they're a corporate or they're an LLC or they're a sole proprietorship, will pay taxes on that if they choose not to spend.
Here it comes. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
We've been given information that tells us that of the small corporations in the state, most of them do not have taxable income. That only 20% of the corporations of this state pay taxes, and they pay the bulk of that amount that comes to the state from corporations. So we're targeting small entities. I don't know that your characterization of a multiplier on the employer's side is accurate.
It may or may not be representative, but there would be a dynamic in that the employer has a reduced cost of employing that person because they're in essence getting this rebate. So what do they do with that money? With that rebate, do they spend it and reinvest it in the economy? Do they just keep it, or are they really not profitable? And they're kind of at that decision point where, you know, I really need to kind of hire this other person, but I just can't quite afford it yet. But you know, if I get a few bucks back here, in this case, $800 over 6 months. Maybe that makes it worthwhile for me to hire that person. So there, it really, representative, to be absolutely honest with you, it's going to really vary from circumstance to circumstance. And I'm not sure that we could ever develop a model and an understanding statistically that we could put on paper that would really accurately depict what's going to occur, because there are so many variables.
Thank you.
So you pose very good questions, and those are the policy considerations that we're wrestling with here, Representative King.
From what I can tell on the sheet here, and I know the Department of Revenue does really good work, but as I look at any number of scenarios, probe them and push those concepts, with the what ifs, I think that these numbers might change a lot. And for example, if we look at 275 firms as being impacted, I'll bet we have more than that, number of restaurants alone, that turn over in a year.
And also, let's assume that you go and put in an average employee counted versus, you know, the numbers I'm representing that they are right now, that you have a construction firm that goes from, you know, 5 employees in the winter to 150 during the summer and ends up with 5 again, you know, the next year, that sounds like they have an average number of employees of pretty close to 75 employees. You know, so the arithmetic, you know, still could have a significant number. And, you know, if there was 30,000, you know, just in the construction industry alone, workers, you know, that came into the marketplace, they're at $45,000, you know, a year.
Right.
And then to do 2.4% of that, you know, that's like a $30 million number. So I, you know, I see the risks to revenue, you know, being larger, significantly than 1.7, and that, you know, as you're saying, we can't put all the scenarios in an econometric model that we might want, but I, you know, I'm seeing in my mind a bunch of them that have a lot higher stakes than that, and I think that those numbers are beyond where you want to go. I think that you'd like to, you know, have a cap there, but then you don't know that you get your cap on the best set of employers, you know, rather than the first set.
Well, where I want to go is create some jobs, and
I think we do have a few bills during, you know, the set of special sessions that, you know, that do help with employment, but I think also it might be true to say that it's more like setting up committees and actually getting some new jobs done. But I do think that in the regular session, you know, what we did in terms of getting economic stimulation in our bridges and highways and construction program, that those are significant and still on target, and that we're holding on to those gains. We haven't cut those out of the budget.
Okay, well, members, Ray, are we ready to talk about the joint memorial, and do we have folks that want to discuss that issue here?
Mr. Chair, I need to get the members of the committee copies, and we need to get a hold of those individuals that want to discuss the memorial.
Members, let's...
No, this is something different. This is a concept for us to consider a joint memorial to Congress regarding rehabilitation and restoration of our forests that have burned this year in federal forest lands in this state. And so we'd like to talk about that and understand why we'd like to ask Congress to consider taking care of those issues as an emergency. It says, urges Congress of the United States to enact an emergency hazardous fuels reduction plan. And that's part of a restoration rehabilitation thing. So we're going to talk about that. Let's take a 5-minute break. Do we have any sense of when we're going to the floor at all?
I know.
7 o'clock?
What?
You don't go to Republican caucus, do you?
We're not going to the floor this afternoon?
We're
second fail, Mama.
We're going to...
I can hear the mushrooms growing as we speak.
Let's stand at ease for a few minutes. And hopefully adopt a draft joint memorial which urges the Congress of the United States to enact emergency hazardous fuels reduction plans. Ray, anything to add in terms of the specifics of the language of the memorial?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's legislative concept 24. When the when your committee does go into a work session, it would be adopting the concept as a committee bill. It would then go down and be processed to get a number.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, you also have 3 individuals in the audience, I believe, that would like to speak to the bill.
Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on LC 24. All 3 of you would like to come forward at the same time? No? Whoever would like to come forward, please do it this time.
Mr. Chairman,
My name is Paulette Kyle, and I'm facilitating these two gentlemen, so I'm going to let them speak.
That's a dangerous thought. My name is Mark Kelly. I work for a group of 14 family-owned forest products companies all in Oregon and one helicopter company, and my responsibilities are to work with them on federal forest policy issues. And perhaps Tim has comments you'd like to make. I think perhaps I could best respond to questions you have, or I can walk through it, whatever you wish.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Tim Wigley, President of the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Salem, and I will start off by saying, you know, we lobby here in the state capitol here in Oregon on state private land, private forest land issues, but certainly with what has happened this past summer, where we've had landowning members of our organization who have seen significant amounts of value of their forest land fall victim to these catastrophic wildfires that, you know, you've had 1 million acres burn of forest land this summer in Oregon alone, and 90% of that 1 million acres has been on federal lands. And that has no doubt already started to impact private landowners who are simply trying to protect their investment, and something has just absolutely got to be done at the federal level, thus this memorial. So we're definitely in support of it.
Okay. Exactly what are we urging Congress to do here in terms of federal forest practices?
What has occurred is that the administration has put forth a proposal to reduce the hazardous fuel loading that resulted from this summer's forest fires. And the one state in the union that's really best equipped to deal with this is Oregon. Idaho, Montana, New Mexico, and Arizona have lost almost all of their mills. So as lands burn in those states, there's really nobody to even come rehabilitate them. Oregon has more privately owned companies that reside here that have been resilient than Washington, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado combined are still here. And what this piece of legislation, although national in nature, would allow is in areas where we have serious catastrophic fires that have occurred, dangers to wildland urban interface, where there's significant dangers to watersheds, it would allow for cleanup and restoration of those lands. So you could move out the dead or burned timber, stand if it's appropriate, and then replant. And this is urging Congress to move forward and get that work done, because where we have had fires, you only have about 18 months to address that wood, and then it's all rotten. And at that point, you can't even pick it up without serious dangers to people. So this says to Congress, let's get on with it so that we can replant, restore our forests. And this will be before the Congress on Thursday for consideration.
All right.
U.S. Senate specifically.
Okay.
Thursday.
So the adoption of this memorial would be timely.
It would very timely. Very.
In terms of encouraging change in federal government practice. Representative Knope?
Mr. Chair, I think we ought to go to work session and start the process of this memorial.
Representative King, your thoughts?
Well, if this is going to hit through the Senate and the House in time for Thursday.
We have to have rule suspension, Representative.
Well, and not only that, but I mean, you may have to. I mean, we're going to get this, you know, adopted tonight.
Yes.
Okay.
So that we can have the opportunity to have
this
first read on the floor tonight,
and possibly the Senate can deal with it tomorrow.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a procedural question, can we have a work session on this when it's still in an LC draft form?
Actually, no. We have to adopt this as legislation in this committee, and then it will be first read on the floor, and then we will either later tonight or tomorrow morning convene as a committee and go ahead and pass the bill out or pass the memorial out. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Chuck. Up on behalf of the citizens in Wallowa and Union and Unitilla and Grant and Morrow and Wheeler, and I think I could go right down the list in Eastern Oregon where over 70% of the land is federally owned. I truly think that this memorial is timely and it's needed, and I compliment you for bringing this forward, and when the time is right, I would be more than honored to make the motion or to even second the motion on this.
Thank you. I appreciate those comments.
I think the time's right, because you're going to have to get this thing drafted. I think time's wasted.
Well, members, I have to tell you that I took a trip to the Bridge Creek Fire from last year out in Ukiah above John Day. Now, this, along with Representative Smith and Representative Jensen and Representative Krieger, about 2 weeks ago, we flew out there and looked at a state lands owned by ODFMW and Parks that had burnt, and we looked at the timber that was bluing, excellent pine timber that was getting that fungal disease in it, and the timber, the value of that timber had already deteriorated by 50%. And this is very fine timber, and there's some great timber up there. And we convinced ODFMW to move forward on their timeline a little bit better. Understand, ODFMW doesn't do a lot of logging because they don't have a lot of land. Okay, so they were frankly quite unclear on the processes, and this it took a little longer than it should have, and they were going to wait until, and no fault of theirs, but they were trying to be hunter friendly and were going to wait until December to start logging. And every day at this point is critical because those logs blew a little bit more every single day during this time of year. And we convinced them to move forward a little more rapidly, and I'm understanding that they'll probably be going forward on an RFP process here almost immediately, hopefully start logging, salvage logging some of that timber. Some of it they can't because of the sensitive soils and so forth, but there is clearly some that can be, and that's an asset that is going to waste on our state grounds that will certainly be used. So it's losing value every day, and that's what we're concerned with here on the federal forest lands. The Biscuit Fire alone, we've done some calculations on Biscuit Fire alone. It's 500,000 acres. There's 180,000 acres of wilderness land there that won't ever have any type of remedial action occur to it. It's going to stay just like it is. But the rest of that land, it's entirely possible that we're looking at calculations of maybe 2 to 3 billion, excuse me, board feet of timber there that's available. It would provide a lot of jobs in our communities. That would provide a lot of money to schools and county roads in some places of this state. And in my mind, it is far better for us to urge Congress to take steps to reduce fire loads so we don't have. And I saw it with my own eyes the other day at Bridge Creek, where the fire had burned through the private forest lands that had been slightly thinned. Fire loads had not totally been taken away because they still leave little clumps for chipmunks and things like that, and some dead snags for birds. But the fire ran low, and it ran fast through it, and it burnt the grass, but it didn't burn the tops out of the trees, and those trees are still growing today. And then where the areas of the federal forest land around Bridge Creek that was very thick, a lot of underbrush, had never been thinned, heavy fire load, it devastated everything. And I'll tell you what was most shocking to me as a farmer is I believe in the ability of the land to produce. This fire burnt so hot, 1,800 to 2,000 degrees, that it melted the elements in the soil. And there's nothing growing there today because it burnt that hot. And so we've actually destroyed the capacity of some of that soil to come back for many years. And that's why I think it's so important that we say to Congress, look, you really have to look at not only what opportunities there might be to use the useful timber that's there, but also look at your management practices so that we don't have this happen again. So that if you get a fire going through there, it doesn't create the tremendous devastation that it has in some places. And that's why we brought this forward today. And members, I would ask, yes, Representative Smith.
Yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was going to make a motion that we would have. We need to be in the work session.
So the public hearing, we're now in a work session. Thank you very much. The chair will entertain a motion to adopt LC 24.
Chairman Krupp, I would make a motion that we adopt a memorial LC draft LC 24.
Any discussion, members? Representative King, Representative Hobson.
No, I've actually got a couple hours of the testimony, but I'll save it when the bill comes back.
Very kind of you, Representative. Representative Hobson, your thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will give you a courtesy vote on this with the understanding that I really deeply want more information. I might even want to hear his couple hours for the testimony at some point.
I'll let you chair the committee at that point in time.
Yeah, right. I agree with the catastrophe that results from disease and from fire. There's no argument about that. And I'm really pleased that ODFNW, I was surprised they did own the land, but that you were able to make an evaluation and that they were able to move forward. That's exactly how it should be. I'm a little concerned about offering that broad-based, generalized direction to Congress to do something, because as we all know, I hate to be trite, but the devil's in the details, and we have this continuum with people who would rather never see a tree ever cut. I don't care if it was 10 months dead, burning and dying of disease altogether. And then we have people who want to cut far more than probably is productive in the long term. So I really believe in an evaluative process in this, and I don't want this to indicate that we are saying move forward post-haste without the evaluation that is inherent in what I think is good management. And there are some words in here that I think are somewhat judgmental, poorly managed forests, those kinds of things. That's where the debate is. There are people who argue that they are well-managed, people who argue that they aren't. So, again, I will give you a courtesy vote because I certainly think there is some merit in this, but I'm a little concerned about the broadness and the breadth and the open doors it might do.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate that. And you should know that even if Congress did enact an emergency hazard reduction plan, that there's still a very consultative process that has to occur to allow any rehabilitation and restoration, any activity in that forest land at all, because some of those soils do get so fragile that it's very difficult to work with them. Members, additional thoughts?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out that likely Senator Daschle would support a moderate bill like this, considering that his legislation, I believe, pretty much waived every law, rule, and regulation as it related to forest. So I would suspect he's probably for this. You might want to call his office and get his support as well.
Okay. All right. Without further ado, and I do appreciate courtesy votes, members, for those of you who are willing to do that. Without further ado, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. All opposed?
A regular aye.
A regular aye? Okay. No opposition. We have adopted LC-24 in its draft form as a committee bill. And with that, I want to close the work session. I want to thank you all for your participation today. We may get together later this evening after floor session. I'm going to reserve the right to call you back in to perhaps attend to some further business. So, at that, I would thank you all.
So you have a specific Chicago.